Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happened?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons?
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery, the Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
How you doing, Adam?
Well, I'm doing fine, because it's Max Fun Drive time, Ben.
Oh, man. Max Fun Drive is the only thing that has given me life right now. I've been sick in bed for a couple of days.
Oh, no.
I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but yeah, my sinuses were full of very evil substances.
It's Max Fun Drive time, and it's sinus infection time for Benjamin R. Harrison. I get a yearly sinus infection, Ben, so I know exactly how you feel, though I'm not feeling that way at the moment. That sucks.
Yeah, it's, I think,
Are you a man who squirts water into their sinuses using the little, squeeze bottle? Are you that guy?
I'm not that guy. Is that a type of guy I should consider becoming?
Well, I would recommend you not... Look, I fucking hate I need to say this just by referring to anything close to this, but, like, we don't dispense medical advice, and I don't recommend you take any from me. But yeah, we only
dispense legal advice.
As long as you don't use tap water, I think that's something to do. That's something to try at least. It's gotten me. Here's what I'll say: it does not prevent a sinus infection, though it does speed its course. I have found by a saline solution. I know you can also buy like saline irrigators over the counter, so you don't have to do the saline mixing yourself. And that also keeps it like sterile, which is, I think, the best thing. Otherwise, you use a tap water, Ben, and you're growing amoeba in your brain.
Yeah, I don't want an amoeba in my brain.
Yeah.
I prefer them to stay well outside of my brain.
Yeah, I want no amoebas in Ben's brain, and I want 25,000 new and upgrading members supporting Maximum Fun during the drive.
Yeah, that's the network's goal is to hit 25,000 new and upgrading members. We never set a goal for this show in particular, but we've been really flattered by the outpouring of support. You know, this is a show that is expensive and tricky to produce. We have a professional editor / producer in Rob Schulte, who works very hard on this show.
I would just call him an editor and a producer. I wouldn't give it a name. I wouldn't give it a description, like professional.
You don't think he's professional?
Until he works for us full time, no.
I mean, he's professional in that he gets paid to do it.
That's true. All right.
And he does it professionally for other shows also.
He has a handmade diploma on his wall about being a podcast producer, so I guess if that qualifies.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, like, this show wouldn't be what it is without him, and...
That's true. It would be nothing without him, because it wouldn't get made.
Yeah, we don't have time to do this crap. but yeah, if you enjoy The Greatest Discovery, if it's one of your weekly listens, please consider supporting it in the Max Fun Drive. How do people do that, Adam?
Well, they go to MaximumFun.org/donate, and they check the box... next to the greatest discovery. That's the maybe the most important thing. Oddly, it's more important than going to the site itself. It's checking the box. Like, I know there, it makes no temporal sense to explain it that way, but checking that box is crucial in making sure that the shows you love get the support that you grant.
Yeah. Speaking of issues temporal, Adam, maybe we should get to this episode, and we'll be back later to talk more about the pledge, you know, the importance of pledging. But right now, why don't we start talking about season 2, episode 10, The Red Angel.
Kind of a lot to unpack in this one. Like, we've talked a lot about the relative density of episodes in season 2 of Star Trek Discovery. This one might be the cheesecakeiest episode of all.
Oh, yeah.
Like, like, you really need a thin slice of episode 10 in season 2. And what it gives you is
Paul Hollywood is really going to be enthused by the close texture of this season.
Really tight crumb on the Red Angel.
Yeah. And watching Mary Berry try and power her dentures through it is going to be a bit harrowing, but she's going to do it. She's going to pull through.
Here's the thing about the funeral scene that begins this episode. Like,
I was surprised to learn that Arium was a Quaker.
It's retroactively instilling more grief into a character we don't know. Like, it's adding stuff to the periphery. We got one episode with her, basically. We got the run-up to her death, and now we get the aftermath. Who had the more saccharine funeral, Ben? Was it Tasha Yar or was it Arium?
Wow. I mean, we knew Tasha before she bought it. So.
We knew her very well, and Data knew her better than anyone.
Yeah, he knew her in the robo-biblical sense.
Did anyone know Arium the way that Data knew Tasha Yar?
I don't know. I mean, that one guy in her beach video, I guess.
Yeah.
Presumably.
But he dead.
Yeah.
I mean, post-robo.
Yeah, I guess...
I mean, that guy knew her no-robo. But who knew her post-robo?
Yeah, you really have to, you know, mark the passage of time as pre and post-robo. It's a pretty interesting little montage while people are speaking their piece at the gathering of friends to celebrate the life of Arium. We get her brain being disassembled and wiped for Data.
Yeah.
We get the security lady and Captain Pike coming in and unshackling Ash Tyler, who is back on the show now.
I wish we got at least one scene between his house arrest and now of Ash Tyler, like, wrapping his bracelet in cellophane before taking a shower. Like, all of the little indignities that come with wearing something that you can't take off. Like, the smell of his wrist...
Yeah, and building like a Lego Millennium Falcon. That would have been fun.
It's so much more hairy than the rest of his wrist. Like taking off a cast.
Yeah, yeah. There was one shot that I thought was particularly interesting in this montage, which was the camera kind of finds Arium's body on a slab, and then it crossfades between her face and Ash Tyler's face.
Yeah.
That seemed to be... very specific.
To me, I mean, the film paper that I write about, that edit, goes something like, both of these people are built of things that are different than the things that are inside them, you know?
Right. They have something at work inside them that is working at odds with their Starfleet allegiance.
Right.
Yeah. This is the first episode... of the season, I believe, directed by Hanel M. Culpepper, who is going to be the first director on the Picard show that has been announced.
Yeah, capably done, I felt, throughout.
I totally agree.
It's also the first episode where we hear Saru sing. And boy, oh boy, Ben, when you are tapped to sing at a funeral, you better be good. And I really, like, braced for what I was about to hear when Saru took his inhalation, right?
I thought it was really weird that we didn't see him singing for the first several stanzas of his song.
Yeah.
because
I didn't think that was right because Doug Jones actually sang this track.
Did he?
Yeah, that's his voice.
What?
I think if he's singing it, like, even though practically he's not, this is not going to be like diegetic singing. Give him a little more face.
Yeah.
In the moment, I think.
I think that the one bit that they got, the lip sync wasn't perfect.
Agreed.
And that kind of ruined it for me.
I assumed
that they had some ringer come in and do the song.
It makes me wonder if they rewrote the song after shooting and there was a reason why they couldn't show him for that reason, because there was no way it would ever match up.
Yeah, it did seem kind of like something was getting covered up there. It's not like, it doesn't like ruin the moment or anything.
Not at all.
It was a little distracting, and like I sat up in my chair both times I watched the episode.
Yeah. Everyone gets a little moment to eulogize Arium, and that's sweet to see. I really liked Detmer's comments a lot, but I thought they were a little awkwardly phrased, you know, like a little on the nose about what it's like to be partially robo and how Arium made her feel okay about that. The sentiment was right, but the dialogue was wrong.
Yeah. I think that what's weird about it is the use of the term augmentation, which means like improvement.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I guess it's especially weird because like the main way we use augmentation in like contemporary language is when we refer to breast augmentation or like butt augmentation.
Right.
So
yeah, those are the only two I'm even aware of.
I mean, you can get like calf augmentation.
Yeah. Well, Ben, I mean, Arium did have augmented breasts. We know that from the schematic that was behind her dead body.
Yeah, we should see the MRI of Arium.
One thing I wanted to call attention to, Ben, were the pallbearers for Arium's casket. It was Owo, Reese, Bryce, and Nilsson, which was the first Arium actor, Sarah Middich.
Yeah, there's a moment later in the episode where she comes on the bridge to replace Arium, and it is so weird. Like, there's like a moment where everybody like processes the awful feeling of a new person coming in to fill the chair of somebody that they just lost and loved. But it's the same actor that played that character last season.
I kind of, like, in real life, I really love the move that Sarah Middich did in order to bail out of the character before she died and then reclaim the position that she took on the bridge.
She really, like, Game of Thrones'd her way back into...
That's some cold-blooded shit, Sarah Middich. I respect it.
Game recognized game.
They shoot that so wide, though, that unless you're really looking for it, I think it's easy to miss. But she's the only crewman with the blonde ponytail, and that made it pretty clear to me at the time. You think they're close enough to the Matara Nebula to shoot the casket into it? Like, is that where it finally goes? That's what I believe.
Wow. So the entrepreneur is flying through that while it's getting shot at by the Reliant in Star Trek II?
Yeah.
Wow. So the funeral breaks up, and Burnham and Ash Tyler wind up on the elevator together, and Burnham is kind of, Tyler is attempting to console her, and Burnham is still ripshit pissed at him, and kind of making the case that allegiance to Section 31 has tainted him in a way very similar to being Voke tainted him in the past.
Yeah. It's taint on taint, isn't it?
Yeah. So she really resists any, like, you know, she cannot be vulnerable around him. She cannot let her guard down because the, you know, like being associated with Section 31 causes her to hate him because of what just happened with Arium. And we get like a little McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
They're talking about like what happened with that space station. The space station's destroyed. Like, they've reformatted all of Section 31's ships and, reset them to factory settings. So they're pretty sure that the future AI of control that has been coming back through the Red Angels wormholes to start this process is contained, but they can't be sure that it's not like lurking somewhere
the way that it lurked within Arium. Right.
Right. And that's why they erased Arium's memories, right? Like,
yeah.
Because it was in there, too.
Yeah. One interesting thing that happens in this scene is, like, for as pissed as Burnham is at Ash, she takes a moment to apologize for the mistaken identity, right?
Right.
But he understands, too. Like, that's kind of a tension that's sort of a burden that Ash carries throughout his life on this show, right? It's always shit gets put on him, but he understands why, and he rolls with it.
He's like me in a lot of ways, you know?
Well, if he were like you, things would actually be his fault.
Yeah, I guess I'm more like Michael Burnham than Ash Tyler.
Right.
So the other thing that comes out in this meeting is that, like, Tilly runs in and does a bunch of Tilly stuff and then explains to everyone that she's found some fragment of information in Arium's memory that leads her to believe that the Red Angel is, in fact, Michael Burnham. Dun, dun, dun.
Hold on. I'm just reviewing the predictions that I made several episodes ago and just putting a check next to that one.
I feel like none of my predictions are coming right.
Yeah, you're a lot like Ash Tyler that way.
Really going back and forth on which character I'm most like.
You contain multitudes, Ben.
Aw, thank you. But yeah, so Culber actually gets the gig of analyzing this bioneural signature, and he is just as convinced as Tilly is. Like, he's like, yeah, like, this would be, like, basically impossible to fake.
Yeah, his explanation of the science here is really well done, I think. Almost no similes at all. Like, like, he speaks practically and realistically and understandably about the situation, which is great. Spock in this scene uses this as an opportunity to make fun of his sister publicly, which is a real treat.
Yeah, like, everybody in the room is kind of exchanging Detmer Oo style glances as he kind of drags his sister. Is the sibling rivalry here that delightful to everybody?
They are making it seem as though it is. Like, Pike is actually smiling, and so is Admiral Bob.
I wonder, like, I mean, this is an episode where the reconciliation between Spock and Michael really starts, and that seems good, but this scene makes me think, like, their rift wasn't actually as serious as the show wanted us to think it was.
And that's unfortunate, I think. By so quickly making light of it, it's tough to take it as seriously as we were meant to. You're right. And yet, if you view it through the lens of Spock being satisfied in humiliating her in front of a group of coworkers, then, like, I guess you could read it that way and see it as holding up.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it kind of seems like everybody in this moment is maybe recognizing something that they have been through themselves.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you know Captain Pike and his brother Daryl. They've had arguments like this before.
The Pike brothers were real terrors around.
Yeah. And when Admiral Bob's sister also got a Bob at a young age. Ooh. You do not want to copycat your sister.
No.
Very irritating. No.
They stopped sharing clothes at that point.
Right.
So they get called to the transporter room, and Leland and Giorgio beam over. And another one of these beam overs where the camera doesn't show you who's beaming over until after everybody else in the room knows.
I can't remember the last time we got a static shot of the transporter room as people beam aboard. That was... Yeah. Basically the only kind that we got on Star Trek The Next Generation, right?
It was really distinctive about this show. And we were talking, I think, in the last episode about just the satisfaction
right. We
get from the shot of the ship being in orbit and then pulling out and going to warp. And I think that you could just toss a normal shot of people beaming aboard every so often and it would feel nice.
I might disagree with you slightly, only because I feel like the former example, I think, is like a necessary component to a Star Trek show. Like, that ship arriving and leaving shot is grounding for a show like this. But I'm fine with them taking visual risks with the beam over and beam off.
Yeah, I just think that like in this particular scene, it doesn't actually add anything yeah. to it. Whereas like the scene where the science officer beams over and the camera is next to his ear so that we see it's not Spock, you know, it was actually doing something with that.
I think this episode was a little less flashy than some of the ones we've come before it.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm getting used to the flash or not, but I kind of feel like that's true.
No, I think you're right about
less
that.
Less upside down transitions.
Yeah.
I'm cringing already.
Georgiou and Leland have arrived to propose a solution to the problem. They want to trap the Red Angel.
They've really leaned into the S&M aesthetic of Section 31, especially with Georgiou's getup in this yeah. scene.
I think Spock is telegraphing his interest in that lifestyle as well, because he's an all-black also.
A lot of real kinksters on this ship.
We find out in a meeting afterward that the Klingons were the first to research time travel, and so began a temporal arms race.
Yeah, and the Red Angel is an invention of Section 31, an anti-Klingon time travel project. I thought it was interesting that Ash Tyler was in the room for this discussion, because it seems like he wasn't privy to this beforehand, right?
I kind of felt like the flatness with which he delivered his line about, you know, confirming a suspicion that the Klingons would have destroyed humanity before emerging from the primordial ooze was said in such a way that, like, that was obvious to him and just as obvious as the rest of what was being said. So, I don't know, questionable for sure.
Yeah. Must have been, like, I want to see that, that like, research station with a bunch of Klingon scientists, you know? Like, what do you seek?
Time travel!
You know, the gauge of syringe in a Klingon medical facility has got to be massive, yeah. right? It's got yeah, to be yeah. like a...
the only people using serrated hypodermics.
Yeah. There is nothing that anesthetizes in a Klingon medical lab, right?
Oh, man. I had a dentist appointment on Friday while I was sick, and getting my teeth drilled while I couldn't breathe through my nose because I was stuffed up was like one of the most awful experiences I've ever had.
You were snot boarded.
Yeah, it sucked, man.
Mm.
But fortunately, they did use anesthetics on me.
So you did not go to a Klingon dental facility?
No. St. Kales Dentist's facility.
So the suit that Section 31 designed was about to be tested when it was destroyed by these Klingon spies. And that is the end of the story that they tell. What they need to do going forward is to find a pattern to the jumps in order to predict when the Red Angel will appear next. And at this point, I'm starting to understand that there's like the Red Angel is being chased by the future AI, because like the moment that the portal remains open when the Red Angel appears is like a very dangerous moment,
right?
That they need to guard against.
The AI is squirting its evil signal through that opening, and unclear on like at this point if the Red Angel is working in concert with the AI or what.
Right.
Georgiou and Burnham have like a little chat in the hallway where Georgiou is kind of putting Burnham onto Leland's scent. We've seen this kind of planted in yeah. an earlier episode where Georgiou has implied that Leland is to blame for the death of Burnham's parents. And now Burnham knows that, you know, like Georgiou doesn't tell her that, but she basically says, like, you better shake the Leland tree and see what falls out of it.
We're fairly certain that Leland scent is Old Spice and leather, right?
Yeah.
You ever walk into, like, I keep using mall analogies. I don't know why, but, like, the store in the mall
that's just your way, Adam.
That sells nothing but leather jackets.
Yeah.
You know that's how he smells. He smells like a leather jacket store.
Are you a leather jacket man?
No, I am not.
I can't imagine wearing a leather jacket.
I just got my first denim jacket, the first denim jacket I've ever owned. I got.
Oh, I saw you in that. You look very handsome in that jacket.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I've got to break it in. Clearly, it feels like wearing Feels like wearing the box to a record player or something.
Oh, yeah. I recommend taking the hanger out before you put it on, Adam.
That's just my posture, Ben. I have told you that over and over again. I've got James Caan posture. God, that reference is going to work for like 10 people.
Yeah, I think Bill Tilly is going to like it.
Yeah.
You never learn to relish a little discomfort, Red?
We get maybe the centerpiece of the episode in engineering.
Coming yeah.
Up. It's a McLaughlin group.
Issue two.
With Stamets, Tilly, and Georgiou for now. What they're doing is they're describing the containment unit as designed. Very Ghostbusters-like situation, I think.
Yeah, there's some technobabble that needs to be gone over in terms of how you get to a situation where you can safely grab the Red Angel before she goes back through her wormhole. And they're coming up with a plan when Dr. Culber walks in. And it's never chill when Culber and Stamets are in the same room at the same time. And
it's just chilly.
Georgiou is loving the tension of this.
And an almost mirror vibe to Tilly's feelings in the moment.
Right. Tilly is me, you know, wanting yeah. to crawl out of her own skin. And Georgiou is like lapping it up.
I love that Georgiou has a nickname for everyone in the room. It's fucking great.
I know. She asks Tilly who raised her, and Tilly starts like oversharing about that.
Yeah.
My mom, but she wasn't around a lot. She's so...
Stop talking.
Yeah, and we get some pretty interesting stuff about the way sexuality works in the mirror universe. Like Stamets and Georgiou definitely had something together there. And we actually were exchanging text messages with our buddy Sam, who is gay, and was just blown away that they actually say "I'm gay" in this scene.
Right.
Like
saying the words being a brand new thing to a Star Trek show.
Right. And that like that had a ton of meaning for him. And yeah. I mean, it definitely stood out to me when I watched the episode, but I was really happy to hear from Sam that it was like good and affirming for him to see that in Star Trek. You know, it's like in such a weird scene where like Georgiou is calling Culber Poppy, and like it really like kind of enjoys the discomfort of the scene. Like the scene enjoys its own sense of discomfort in the way that Georgiou is enjoying it.
When Culber states his and Stamets' sexuality, it almost goes without saying, given that he's dressed like Karl Lagerfeld.
RSVP.
Yeah. Here's another thing I want to say about this scene. Like, for as affirming and good as it is for this representation to occur in this moment, Georgiou is doing a fair amount of, like, she's basically telling Stamets that she could turn him.
Yeah.
And that there is a hostility in that that is a little uncomfortable, right? Like, it's not all good in this scene, for sure.
The human resources department is going to have some major concerns about the way she is interacting with her coworkers in this scene.
Yeah.
So Culber was looking for Admiral Bob, but instead is just, like, left there with Tilly and Stamets.
Also, fuck you, Culber. You know where Admiral Bob is. Like, you didn't just accidentally go to engineering looking for her. Like, everyone knows where everyone is on the ship.
Yeah. Maybe the storyline in this episode that strains credulity the most is that, like, two scenes 10 minutes apart are about Culber looking for Admiral Bob.
And the fact that Culber thinks to look in Admiral Bob's quarters last is being...
Yeah, well, she's always the last place you look, you know?
Yeah.
But maybe it shouldn't be so simple.
But you gotta have this scene in the ep, Ben. Like,
yeah.
I feel like in many ways they started with this scene and worked outward.
Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. Are you feeling confident still in your prediction that Stamets and Culber don't get back together?
Honestly, I still am. I don't know if the show is willing to keep them apart, but I feel truly that what is right is that they remain apart.
Whoa. Fuck. if that scene wasn't uncomfortable enough, the next scene is Michael Burnham extracting the truth from Leland, and the truth being that her parents were like some kind of high-flying, super-secret research scientists for Section 31, so secret that Michael Burnham didn't even know about it as a kid.
I love how pissed off she is, this, that she didn't realize her parents were in the CIA as a kid. Like, why would they
tell
you
about that?
8-year-old Michael Burnham? Like, like that would ever happen.
I mean, I like, yes, but also like emotionally probably true to like, as an adult, find out that your parents had a dark secret like that and have it, you know, like you only have childhood associations with your parents. So the like idea that they would be lying to you about something like that would be tricky to incorporate into the way you think about them.
Right.
And yeah, the deal was that they built, specifically Michael Burnham's mom built the Red Angel suit, and that they had like procured a time crystal, which is a thing that we learned existed in that Harcourt Fenton Mudd episode.
Right.
But it was a Klingon time crystal, so the Klingons came looking for it and killed everybody. And
it was very sharp. That's how you know it was a Klingon version. It was pointy.
Yeah, yeah, and wider gauge than is strictly necessary.
And there were two offshoots of it.
But Leland was like young and ambitious and careless and got people killed and has apparently lived with some regrets about this episode. But Michael Burnham does not feel like he's sufficiently regretful, so she punches him in the nose, once for mommy and once for daddy.
There's it's not just Michael Burnham feeling terrible about the secret being hidden from her. Like, this is her origin story, is that moment in the closet listening to her parents getting killed, and to know that there was a greater truth there is incredibly damaging to her.
Yeah.
Like, she's made every choice in her life based on that moment in the closet. It's awful.
Yeah.
Her line read of, I thought, was amazing.
She's incredible in this scene. Like, she, like the whole scene, she really lets these moments breathe as you see her kind of doing the Rubik's Cube of what Leland is telling her in her mind. And it really breaks her. It is really devastating.
In a show that is willing to use the F word fairly casually, I thought this might have been a good moment for that, and a good and grounded moment. Like, I think the first time we heard it was Tilly saying how science fucking rules, but right. I think a fuck you would have been appropriate here in that moment. Or
a middle finger, double middles, something.
Bloody middles. Because Burnham fucking almost takes his nose off.
Yeah. Speaking of dealing with trauma, Adam, Culber finally finds Admiral Bob and hits her up for a free therapy session. First one's free.
It's a good thing Admiral Bob's therapy lamp is on. It's very comfortable.
Yeah, it's nice, like, it's nice moody lighting. She's got those matching Eames chairs there.
Uh-huh.
And Culber is really, you know, having a tough time sorting things out because he definitely doesn't feel like present current love for Stamets, but he also has strong memories of that and doesn't want what he's going through to be unnecessarily painful for Paul. That's the cross that Culber is bearing that he kind of needs some help with.
You know, for as therapeutic as this conversation is between Culber and Admiral Bob,
yeah, it's always nice in movies and television to see a single therapy session really help somebody out, you know, like, because in real life, the first time you meet your therapist, it's like you spend an hour like telling them what you think is wrong with you. And then you spend like the next 7 weeks trying to articulate that more and more. And then they're like, oh, like none of the things that you said in that first session are what's really eating you. They're actually these other things.
Yeah.
But for dramatic expedience, I will accept it.
Well, what I'm not willing to accept is what I was getting at, which is Admiral Bob tells Culber what to do and does not listen to him. Like, everyone on the ship is conspiring to put him back together with Stamets, and I don't think that's right. She says love is a choice, and I don't agree with that statement at all. Like, she's by saying that to Culber, she's saying you should choose to love Stamets because it's the right thing to do. She's not respecting his agency or his situation. And I don't think it's the responsibility of a therapist to tell a patient what to do. Look, I'm saying that as someone who is not as experienced in therapy as you, obviously, but I thought that was shitty. I think Culber needs time to fucking breathe. And even though he's there for help, I thought it was wrong for Bob to continue this conspiracy.
I understand where you're coming from on that, but I do think I fall on the other side of the argument. Like, my experience with therapy does involve, to some extent, being told things that I can do to change my situation. And sometimes, sometimes, like, you get in the habit of doing things that are, you know, stopping you from achieving your goals, and you're doing them out of habit, not because they're like the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the subtext of what Culber is saying is that there is still some love and affection there, but he doesn't know how to express it or act on it in a way that feels authentic and real. And that's why I really like that final line where she says, like, the way you, like, make a road as you walk down it. I don't think she's saying you have to go love Paul per se. I think she's saying, like, you need to walk this road, and, like, nobody can really tell you exactly, you know, what's going to happen. I don't know. Did that make sense? I'm a little, like, doped up on Dayquil.
No, it does make sense. I just think that we take opposing positions on the scene, and I think that's fine. I think I think you view it through the lens of your choosing, but I think it speaks to a greater environment around the ship that I'm resistant to, and I just felt like this was an example of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I do agree with you that, like, everybody seems to have that opinion, like, including Spock, which is crazy.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of Spock, there is a scene to come where Spock walks in on Michael Burnham. That's the one thing you don't want to do to a sibling. and she happens to be beating the shit out of some... What are the... I wanted to say sock'em boppers, but those are the boxing gloves that you inflate on your hands. What's the thing that you hit that... It's a Weeble Wobble, right? She's hitting the Weeble Wobbles. Yeah, and she is going to town on these foam dummies.
Spock really respects that she beat up Leland.
She's wearing an athletic garment that does not breathe at all, Ben.
Maybe it's one of those things that you wear for, like, weight loss.
You know, she's going to put that in the wash, and all of its moisture-wicking properties are going to go away because you accidentally use detergent and you're not supposed to. Don't you hate that?
That sucks.
Yeah.
You got to look at the tags before you buy the garment, you know?
Yeah.
She really beats the hell out of this thing. Like, I really liked that the paint on it was, like, worn away and scuffed in places.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that was a pretty interesting choice. Like, things tend to look very perfect and clean in Star Trek.
Yeah.
And the idea that this thing has seen some use and has some patina on it was cool.
They come to an understanding together about how it feels to have their logical and emotional sides in conflict at the same time. And this conversation builds to a climax where Spock accepts her apology.
Yeah, and she's apologizing for something kind of surprising, I think, which is for bringing her guilt and feeling of culpability for the death of her parents into his house. Like, she is imagining that what she was going through had a direct line to the way she treated him when she ran away. And he makes a great point, which is that, like, you're apologizing for having an appropriately childlike reaction to a super heavy situation. And while I, you know, kind of reject the premise of it, I will accept the apology because I want to take that weight off your shoulders.
I think this scene is one of the best moments of Sonequa Martin-Green as Michael Burnham on the show. The moments after the apology is accepted is so, it's so subtly great.
Yeah.
It is so effective on her part. And she has a couple moments in the ep that are as good, maybe none better than this moment, but I thought this was a great episode for her.
Yeah, the through line from episode one of season one to now feels so strong.
Yeah.
Like this idea that she is the person that takes 100% of responsibility for everything all the time and always feels the most guilty about everything.
Yeah.
And that being like something that Spock, in a very loving way, is trying to help her unburden herself of is very interesting.
Yeah. She was an only child. She did go to a tennis academy. I'm starting to see the resemblance.
Yeah.
You just need to find some time to beat the shit out of some Weeble Wobbles, Ben.
I feel like they're really making this series of Star Trek at me.
Do you feel seen?
I feel seen. For once in my life, I feel seen.
Spock sort of by the way is Michael Burnham at the end of this.
Yeah.
And the by the way is that he's figured out the reason, or he's figured out a way to predict the Red Angel's appearance. And
he's like, you know how Ben thought that there were going to be hollow emitters when he was making predictions at the end of the last episode? Ben was wrong.
It was weird that Ethan Peck just sort of turned to camera to deliver that.
Really surprising to see them break the fourth wall in that way here and now.
The IO9 article reviewing this episode, the title of that was, "Who is Benjamin R. Harrison?"
I know.
What are they talking about?
It's an ongoing source of grief for both of us that IO9 does not know who or what we are.
Right.
But here we are.
Yeah, so the Red Angel appears outside of the Seven Signals only when Michael Burnham's life is threatened. And it's surprising that it took several days for him to realize this.
Well, it's not only when it's when lives are threatened, but like when hers was threatened specifically, it did show up. So
yeah.
They figure out that if they want to make the Red Angel appear, they threaten her life specifically, and the Red Angel will show up.
There's a great place not far away to threaten Michael Burnham's life, Ben, and that's Esau 4. It's the mining facility there.
It's a planet that is a real dump. It's the they beam down and they're like, "Wow, this place is a dump." Saru's like, "Wait, do you see the pool? No water." But yeah, I guess the idea is that it will kill her over the course of a number of seconds or a minute or two, so the Red Angel will have an opportunity to show up. Because, like, they could just shoot her in the head with a phaser, right?
Yeah, but that's not what Section 31 likes to do. I think you understand, finally, just exactly what kind of shit that they're into when you realize that there's a chair and some straps and some breath play that's going to happen.
There's some nasty little kinksters.
Yeah. Yeah, Section 31. Club you really have to look hard to find.
What they've come up with is that they're gonna set up all these emitters that will trap the Red Angel, you know, disconnect her from the thing that she leaves on the other side of the wormhole, I guess. Because I guess like their logic is like she keeps opening these wormholes and controlled, like evil AI future control sends its signals back, and that keeps perpetuating this AI problem that we're having. So if we can stop her from opening these wormholes, our problems will be solved, man.
What if it doesn't work?
Well, maybe they could just keep Michael Burnham out of trouble. Maybe that would prevent these things from happening.
Or you go drop Michael Burnham off on Earth and be like, needs of the many, etc. Yeah. All right, later.
I'm sure you get it.
She just gets like a desk job at Starfleet Academy. So yeah, there's a few moments before this, like of particular note, is the moment where she and Ash Tyler talk about the fact that she's going to go threaten herself with death. Like, one confrontation that we didn't talk about is the fact that she like runs up to him after beating up Leland and goes like, "Did you know this Section 31 thing about my folks?" And he's like, "What? Huh?
Did you believe him?"
I did.
We have no reason to, but I did also. But like, we shouldn't ever, right? That's sort of the magic trick of this character in this show, is that we keep going back to Ash Tyler when we have no reason to.
I've worked for a couple of companies where when I got hired, I wasn't like curious about old shit that the company had done, you know? And I think that that's kind of the deal here. Like, he's a fairly new employee of Section 31, so why would he give a rip about some bonehead move that Leland pulled 30 years ago or whatever?
I just... Hey, honey, I got a new job. What is it? Border security.
Yeah. Well, and that's like what she says, right?
I don't know anything about their job or their mission, but it sounds pretty important. And it's a paycheck.
Yeah. I mean, that's the case that Burnham makes several times in this episode, is like, your association.
I go back and forth to the border with a truck full of tiny cages.
Asking questions about what the tiny cages are for? Not really my pay grade.
No. I'm just going to keep driving this truck and ignoring the banging from the back.
That's the case that Michael Burnham makes several times in the episode. It's like you have aligned yourself with this organization, and he's like, "Well, I don't like always agree with their tactics, but I agree with the mission," which is like not that big, not that good of a defense, you know?
Right. No, it's not.
But they get on with it. They build this mousetrap. They strap Michael Burnham into this chair, and they open the door, and we get
a... We built this mousetrap. We built this mousetrap to catch the angel.
You have a beautiful singing voice.
I don't have a sinus infection. That's why...
That's why you're doing all the songs this episode.
We get that scene that we referred to earlier, Ben. The Lieutenant Nilsen takes her station, and we get what I'm just going to call... I'm gonna name a new thing, Ben. When bridge crew members look at each other in reaction, I'm going to call that a do-o. The Detmer o-o glance proliferates around the bridge.
That's a hell of a combination.
Poor Nilsen. It's a tough first day on the job.
They strap Michael Burnham in. She's the only one in a regular uniform. Everybody else is in a spacesuit. And they go close themselves off in a room that is not going to be exposed to the atmosphere of this shitty planet. And then they open the doors up. And fuck, this scene is rugged.
The Last Temptation of Christ level depiction of Michael Burnham's agony was surprising to me. And she does such a compelling job that I noticed for a show that usually shows a bunch of reaction shots to teach a viewer how to feel, they kind of dialed that back a little bit because Sonequa Martin-Green was so scary in this moment.
It is very scary. It is like it was uncomfortable for me both times to watch it. Yeah. I wondered why Pike didn't say, like, "Can you turn the audio down or something?" Like,
yeah. Variance was the safety word, and that does not get her out of the chair Spock knows. Spock knows that it's instructional and not safety.
Right. What Spock realizes is what Michael Burnham realizes. Like, the threat to her life has to be real. There can't be a safety net on this one to actually, like, if the Red Angel doesn't think that plausibly she's gonna die. And the logic of this is that the Red Angel is Michael Burnham from the future, so she would cease to exist if she was killed, and they need to convince future Michael Burnham to come back to save her own life.
Yeah.
So Spock goes and like stands by the door and holds everybody hostage with a phaser, and they actually let her, you know, breathe her last breath.
Yeah, pretty hard to watch. And everyone watches it. Like, the Discovery watches it. Section 31 watches it. Those on the ground on ESA 4.
She flatlines, and Pike is like, get her out of there, beam her up, and there's too much interference. And they're like, and I think it's Admiral Bob that asks what the interference is from. And turns out it's from the Red Angel. Never on schedule, but always on time.
The interference is not from Sinequa Martin Green Brandoing. Like, Sinequa Martin Green does everything short of Brando in this scene.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised if she Brandoed. I mean, they could have built something into that chair, you know?
Yeah, like a hole.
Yeah. That thing might be a toilet. and the Red Angel shoots a
That's
beam.
That's the name of your porno.
The Red Angel shoots a beam at her chest that brings her back to life. And then they spring the trap, bring the Red Angel down. She steps out of the suit and kind of like falls to her knees. And
I love how the suit ejects her. Like, it's not wrapped around her in a unique
way. It dematerializes in the front.
Yeah, yeah.
And then rematerializes. And then it's just standing there.
It probably helps a person pee, right? If if it just comes off the front.
Yeah, that is way better than the little slot in the underpants that you're supposed to thread your penis through.
or if you're a lady inside the suit, the suit probably comes with its own stadium buddy.
Yeah, I mean, you can Brando in that suit all day.
And who from the suit should appear, Ben? Kima Greggs from The Wire.
Yeah. Sonya's son.
Maybe my favorite character from The Wire. It's hard to pick a favorite. But just hearing Sonya's son's voice again, so great. So satisfying. Yeah. One of the great voices in television, I think.
Seriously. And she is Michael Burnham's mom.
Yeah.
What?
This is great casting, I think. Who else could be her mom?
It fucking short-circuited my brain because her head is kind of like down initially, and when she looks up, I was so primed for it to be Michael Burnham looking up, that I was like, what? Kima?
Yeah,
that was like a great television moment.
I couldn't be sure that it was future ruggedized Michael Burnham because the resemblance was so good.
Yeah.
Until they really cut back to her and you heard her voice.
But I also like never would have said like, oh yeah, Sonya's son looks a lot like Sinequa Martin Green.
No, I wouldn't have put that together either. It's the contextual element that totally sells it.
Right. Yeah, it's wild. We should not gloss over the scene immediately preceding this where Leland is like trying to do something with his computer and it stabs him in the eyeball.
It's a scene that will turn off a generation of people from an optometrist.
Yeah, a lot of big television moments in the end of this episode.
I don't know how anyone could get an eye exam and not think of this scene if they'd watch this episode. That is pretty scary.
Why does Star Trek Discovery want us to see people stabbing themselves in the eye so much?
I don't know.
It keeps happening.
Yeah. It's a very Star Trekian form of body horror.
Yeah. Well, did you like this episode, Adam?
Yeah, I really did. I mean, it seems like it's doing the 10 pounds of story in a 5-pound bag thing, but it somehow is able to keep containment. And the show has a mixed history of its ability to do that.
Yeah.
The reveal at the end was satisfying in its surprise. Like, I am reflexively against surprises like this. Like, I feel like it's manipulating or teasing the viewer, but I didn't feel that in the moment. I went along with it.
Yeah.
Which I think makes it a good episode. I think, like, everything led up to this moment, and I thought it did a good and satisfying job of it.
Do you think that... So, like, the whole premise of Michael Burnham killing herself here was that they had like very definitive evidence that the brain inside of the Red Angel was Michael Burnham's brain. Do you think that the case is going to be that like that signature would be similar from mother to daughter and that's why they were confused? Or do you think that Michael Burnham is going to get in that suit?
I wonder if there aren't multiple angels. One of the angels is the one that appear with the red signal, and the other one appears when Michael Burnham's life is in trouble. Maybe there are multiple wearers.
Hmm. Yeah.
I could see that being the case. Because if you exist out of time, like, I could totally see that being the case. I could see the case for there being multiple wearers also. If time doesn't exist, it means you have all the time in the world to create right. more suits or give them to people that you think should wear them. It's a crazy problem to wrap your mind around.
Yeah. I think we can be reasonably confident that there's one time crystal.
Yeah.
I feel like time crystal is a very corny idea, but it's actually kind of smart to like limit the potential ramifications of the existence of this technology.
You know what, though? I'm actually going to say no, that can't be true, because if there were only one, everyone in the universe's resources would be brought to bear on that Orion market to take it back. And the story that Leland tells makes it seem like a pretty small black op in an ecosystem of many other black ops. Like, if I've got to believe that there's more than one.
Hmm.
I'm going to say that.
I mean, Mud had one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Did they get destroyed at the end of that episode?
I don't know.
I forget.
I feel like that set from the Harry Mud Short Treks ep was Esau 4, when Mud is walked through that space station in chains, and we were commenting on all the parking spaces for spaceships that we didn't get to see.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's the same set, that long hallway.
Oh.
I don't know. That's what I thought.
Oh, fun. They probably, yeah. I mean, there definitely seems to be like an industrial building set that they've used for like when they rescued Tig Notaro. Wasn't there kind of like a room that looked like that?
Yeah.
There's always like sparks falling from the ceilings or it's like dry and bombed out looking.
Speaking of Tig, I feel like Emperor Georgiou is the quip master when Tig is not around. And I hope we get a scene at some point where the two of them are quip battling together. I think that would be very fun.
Wow.
What about you, Ben? Did you like the episode?
I did. I don't have much to add to what you've already said, but I thought it was very enjoyable, and I really loved the twist. I wonder if you don't get Sonia San for that part, if it's as big a moment.
Yeah, I wonder that too. You hope she picks up the phone when you make that inquiry.
Yeah.
Ben, this is not an original thought, but I did want to ask you this question before we got to the end. One of the questions I read online was, why wipe Arium's memories instead of keeping them or giving them to a loved one? I think we know practically that the reason they did that was to destroy any potential for control to exist outside of their control. Like, I know control right. versus control is an awkward way to say it, but like the one way to ensure that it doesn't pop back up again is to destroy it. But I think that was an emotionally interesting moment that isn't given any time to breathe, because by destroying her memories, there's something to grieve there in that moment. And it's so clinical mm-hmm. and without emotion that I think that deserved a little bit more. I think maybe cross-cutting it between the eulogy does that to a degree, but I don't know. Something about that sticks in my mind.
Huh. I mean, I don't feel like it was said so definitively, like that there wouldn't necessarily be a thumb drive with the beach video on it somewhere.
Yeah.
They wiped her memory, but I don't know if they wiped every single thing that she ever remembered. So, I don't know.
Yeah. We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
I did. My Shimoda in this episode is Dr. Culber. Both for the thing of looking for Admiral Bob for 20 minutes. And, like, you know, it's a little hard to tell how much time passes between the first scene and the second scene where he walks into a room looking for her. But I would imagine that it could be as much as, like, a day has gone by.
I love the idea of, you know how, like, when you were little and you lost your parents in a supermarket, you just walk perpendicular to the aisles, like, looking down everyone. It's not a good look for Culber to be, like, a lost child on the ship looking for Admiral Bob. He's smart, and we know he is.
Yeah. But the other moment I wanted to call out is that scene where they've got Michael Burnham, like, breathing her last breath on the other side of that door, and Pike is like, what the hell is going on down there? Get Culber in there to save her. And he radios back up to Pike, and he says, like, we can't because Lieutenant Spock is holding a gun to us or something like that. And both times I watched it, it sounded to me like I heard it wrong and then realized what he had said. And what I heard it wrong as was Lieutenant Fuck is has us at gunpoint. And very apt, I think, Dr. Culber.
I love that they tilt over to Joaquin and he, like, bangs his his controls, and he's like, I can't! Nice little callback to Wrath of Khan from the show.
Cool.
I like that. I like all the little callbacks.
Good to see Jensen Scott getting work these days. Adam, did you have a drunk Shimoda?
I mean, we make jokes a lot about the kinks that the characters on the show might have.
Yeah.
And I think one of the rules, I think, about a person's predilections is that sometimes sharing those with other people can be unwelcome in the wrong circumstance.
Sure.
I was not aware that Pike wanted to show everyone his breath play videos by putting Michael Burnham up on the screen unnecessarily, I felt. Like, on the one hand, I get it. Valued member of the crew, you want to keep a watchful eye over her circumstances. But wow, what I think a lot of people on the bridge wouldn't have given to just see, like, a heart rate, you know? Yeah.
And it's fucked up that he's, like, kind of zhuzhing himself while while it's going on.
I think what makes me think that is the strength of Sonequa Martin-Green's performance. If it's not 10 out of 10 or 11 out of 10, I think this scene goes by in a way that doesn't read as, like, emotionally hostile as it is.
Yeah.
But it's so tough because she's so great that I think the I think it makes the case for itself in a fucked up way. It's dark and amazing and hard to believe that it exists in a Star Trek show as it is. But the Shimoda choice itself is going to be Pike for, I hope, regretting that decision. I hope there's something in him that goes, really sorry about that gross out. I didn't think she was going to Brando. What do we have coming up on the next episode, Ben?
Well, it looked to me like a lot of the next episode is going to take place in this same kill chamber that this episode ended in.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they've entrapped the Red Angel in a way that makes moving her possible.
Yeah, so she's saying something about how time always wins, and we got some scenes of Klingons and like a bird looking ship that I thought might be more flashbacks to the scene of Michael Burnham's parents being finger quotes killed.
Right.
So I mean, we're gonna have to figure out what happened there, right? Because they don't appear to have been killed as she was led to believe.
Less than killed.
So yeah, I mean, it all went by pretty fast, but that's what I got out of the vasectomy that we were shown at the end of this episode. I've been hearing online that some people are not seeing these little next time on Star Trek Discoveries.
That's weird.
I've never not gotten them.
Yeah, me neither.
But it's like, I guess the streaming platform might be just like dynamically adding them to the episodes. Like, I don't know.
I use
the CBS All Access app on my PlayStation 4. So I don't know. I'd be curious to hear what people are using to watch it. Maybe if you're watching in a browser on your computer, it doesn't show it or something.
Yeah, I would recommend watching them if you can. I think they're good little packages.
Yeah, that's a good package.
Speaking of, we have an episode package to deliver to Rob for editing. So
yeah, we sure do.
I think he's got some comments on his own, thanking you for supporting the show and him and his work here.
Yeah, we really appreciate everything Rob does, and we really appreciate the folks who enable us to employ Rob, because we couldn't do this without him. So we'll let him take it away.
This is the last pledge drive ep for The Greatest Discovery. So yeah, Thank you to everyone who has supported the show up until now. Thank you in advance for those who were going to turn off the show and immediately go to MaximumFun.org/donate to support it.
Yeah, you have until March 29th to support, but do it right now so you don't forget.
And we'll give it on over to Rob, who is waiting in his chair restraints.
Yeah, we should probably close those doors, huh?
Yeah.
I do have a couple of things to say, and I don't want to just repeat myself all the time, so I'm going to tell a little story, and it's going to be quick, because I tend to be long-winded and say extra words. I was working at a major media organization that had long hours, contract only, perma-freelance, quite frankly, a content machine. Not as much fun. And one day, I get a phone call from Benjamin R. Harrison, and he said, there's actually a new Star Trek show coming out. And I said, I'm in. Ben's fun to work with. Adam is fun to work with. This show is fun to work on. And the audience and listeners and everyone that supports the show makes it worth it. It's about what we're doing, the fun we're having, and the people that enjoy what we're making. It's great. Not only that, when you support through Maximum Fun, you get all of the awesome rewards that Ben and Adam have already talked about. So why not support a show you like on a network you like? I really, really appreciate all of the support. Thank you all. And remember, our theme music for this show and all of the interstitials come from the great Adam Ragusea. You can follow Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR. Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. Make sure to use the hashtag GreatestDiscovery or GreatestGen when you're talking about the show on social media. And tell a friend. Get a donation buddy. Hold hands together while you hit donate. Right now, go do it. MaximumFun.org/donate.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
audience supported.